This is Andrew Johnson, and I'll be talking to Tina Foster, and it's the 21st of January 2012. Okay, I'm here today with Tina Foster, and I decided to ask Tina to do a podcast with me, or a recording, because I'd been interested in this sort of idea or evidence that Paul McCartney, sometime in his past, was replaced with a double, and I think this is one of these things which people find very difficult to swallow. And, much like a lot of the other things that I talk about and discuss, unless you look at the evidence, you just would not believe the actual conclusion that you come to. It's really quite otherworldly at times when you come to these things. And so I contacted Tina, and she agreed to do this podcast with me, and I sort of wrote down a list of questions which I'll try and go through. And I'm very happy that Tina has agreed to spend some time with me to talk about these somewhat troubling issues. But I think Tina is like the rest of us. She wants to get to the truth. She wants to look at the evidence. And she's been doing a very good job of that so far, from what I can tell. So hello, Tina.
Hi, Andrew. How are you?
I'm not too bad overall. Thank you very much on this mild winter's day, as we were discussing. I think, it'd be useful for people to know a little bit about you, as much as you want to tell us. And then again, how you sort of got into this sort of area of looking at things a different way.
Sure. Well, my background is I have a master's in Germanic studies. I have a JD, a doctor of jurisprudence, and an advanced law degree called an LLM in environmental law. And I'm licensed and practicing in Washington State as an attorney. And I got involved in the PID research, which stands for Paul is Dead, in August of 2008, when I was researching something else, and I came upon a link to one of Sun King's sites. It's a Digilander. And I thought that I would look into it for a couple of minutes, decide it was bogus, and move on. But the more I looked into it, the more I saw that there was a difference, and I got hooked and started researching it. Forgot what I was researching before, and
so that's basically been, you must be coming up, well, it's over 3 years, obviously, and that you've been doing that. And again, I mean, with the work that you're doing, it's got to be pretty much evidence based, hasn't it? So, my background, as I've told people before, is in software engineering, which is obviously very different from practicing law, but you're still looking at something which is very evidence based. You're writing software, you've got to look at how it works, what it does, when it fails, and this sort of thing. So, and again, obviously being an analytical, having an analytical technique, analytical mindset, you need that to do your job. So I think you can't help but apply those skills to the research. I mean, that's certainly been my experience, and I'm sure, you're no different in that respect.
Exactly.
And I think, just to mention that, that useful abbreviation there, that we all get used to working with, PID, Paul is Dead. And then we have this, the converse of that, which is PIA, which is Paul is Alive, I'm presuming, unless I've...
Yes.
Right. So, what really struck me when I first came across this, I'd heard the stories, I think as most, perhaps you'd heard them as well, the rumour that, the cover of Sergeant Pepper, I think the bit of it that I heard was, on the cover of Sergeant Pepper, there is somebody holding their hand above Paul's head. I can't remember if it's the real Paul or the waxwork Paul. And that, they were saying, oh, that was a hidden symbol that Paul is dead. And everyone looks, sort of goes, ha, 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 yes, that's really funny. You know, and then you move on to the next thing. But, I think really what we can look at is some of the forensic evidence, which seems to show that that Paul did actually change, and so perhaps you could go through some of the main points of that for us, Tina.
Sure, absolutely. Well, some of the differences in the anatomy were people first started noticing in 1967 that there was a difference in Paul. So that's when the rumor of PID was born. Then in 1969, it actually became world news that Paul had been replaced. But when Life magazine did an interview with Paul, supposedly, it laid the rumor to rest. But PID has been in the public consciousness for many years. So in 2009, two forensic scientists in Italy published an article in Wired Italia. This was the August 2009 issue. Mm-hmm. And these scientists were Francesco Gavazzini and Gabriele Carlesi. And I don't speak Italian, so I might have said that wrong. But Gavazzini is a computer scientist involved in information technology. And Carlesi is an expert in anatomy and craniometrics. So they had heard of the PID rumor, and it unsettled them, and they wanted to prove that it was just a rumor, that it was a hoax. But when they started looking into it, they found these differences that were not easy to explain away with surgery or with error. So one thing they noticed was about the nose and the nasal spine in particular, which is the point between the nostrils where the nose juts out from the face. And they said it's a distinctive feature that can't be altered by surgery. And they were noticing differences from before, so like mid-1966 and after that time. And they even hinted that the mustache that McCartney started wearing in late 1966 might have been used to conceal that part of the nose, the nasal spine. And so they didn't talk about this, but other researchers have noticed that the tip of the nose changed. Paul's was slightly upturned, and McCartney's is more beakish. And if you look at the single for the cover of Another Day, it has McCartney on the cover, and if you look closely, you can see that the nose tip is a different color from the rest of the skin. So it actually looks like there's a dark base on it, but it has that upturned look that you don't see on other pictures of him. So we think that might be a prosthetic.
Right. Right. And just sort of pause on that for a minute. Mm-hmm. Is there any sort of, you know, talk, or was there any talk that you're aware of that, you know, he'd had actually what we'd call a nose job these days, you know, plastic surgery on his nose, you know, he'd got into a fight or he walked into a door and, you know, he'd broken his nose or something like that. Has there ever been any talk of that anywhere?
Well, there's people have seen what they think are scars, maybe from surgery. Paul was in a moped accident in late 65 where he chipped a tooth, but he seems to have gotten that repaired and didn't look like there was any structural damage to his face. So I don't think that accounts
for it. Okay.
Right. So then the forensic scientists were talking about the mandibular curve of the jaw. And so they were saying in Paul, before 1966, before the switch, the jaw had two curves. And then in 67, there was only one curve. And they were saying that the difference in the measurement was over 6%, which was well beyond the margin of error.
So, yeah, and something like that, I mean, you're talking sort of major bone work, aren't you? You know, you're sort of outside the idea of a nose job or whatever. You know, you've got major sort of structural changes in the skull there.
Exactly. And so the one thing that they were noticing about the palate, if you're talking about major reconstructive surgery, they were saying that before mid-1966, Paul had a small palate, which caused his teeth to become misaligned. And starting with Sgt. Pepper, the album cover, his palate widened considerably. And back in the 1960s, it was possible to change the shape of the palate, but it would have required maxillofacial surgery, which would have been very traumatic, and they would have had to open the palatal suture, break the bone, and insert a prosthetic implant. And so a singer, this could have potentially ruined a singer's career. And Barbara Streisand had once considered rhinoplasty, but she decided not to do it because it could have impacted her singing voice. And so Paul, if he had restructured his palate, he would have had to have had continuing orthodontic treatment. He would have had to wear braces for a year, and this would not have been something he could have hidden.
Right. So, I mean, that would have been a major disruption to his, you know, time doing recordings and so on.
Right. And then another part of the anatomy was the lips. They were saying that the oral commissure, which is the line that the lips make when they meet, the upper and the bottom lip, it became wider. It was stretched, which is technically not possible. So in 1967, it was wider. And you can maybe make the lips wider, or not wider, but you can increase them with volume. Women do that with, not Botox, but they get injections and it makes them puffier. But you can't make the mouth wider. And so the mustache, too, if you look at how McCartney was wearing his mustache, it kind of tries to hide the sides of the mouth, kind of make it appear like they're not as wide. Then also on the lips, the difference is in the Cupid's bow, which are the points on the top of the lip. So if you look at Paul, it's very pointy. And on McCartney, it's flatter. So we talked about the teeth. We've said that the palate was small.
Yes.
In Paul, and so it made his teeth become misaligned. And in particular, his upper right canine was kind of sticking out from the line where the rest of the teeth were. And, but that tooth, after 1967, it didn't do that anymore. So.
Right. So he'd had some dental work as well. So, you know, we're looking at him having had some, you know, if we just, let's just say, you know, he had some surgery or something, then it looks like he had nasal surgery, dental surgery, you know, and major jaw surgery.
Right. Right. And so they were also noticing differences in the ears. So the tragus was something in particular that they mentioned. The tragus is a small cartilage covered with skin that overhangs the entrance of the ear canal. And so they were saying that was a different structure in the right ear, and it's something that can't be changed with surgery. And the earlobes were attached prior to 1966, and then they were unattached. And also you see evidence of prosthetics.
Right. And that's one thing I wanted to mention, actually, because I have a friend who's a musician. He's he's actually been involved in the music scene. I think he knows, he's sort of on the fringes of the music scene, or the popular music scene, I might call it. I think he did actually meet with a few guys who knew some of the Beatles or something. So he's like one set of friends removed from people who, you know, knew the Beatles or something, from what I've gathered from this chap. And there was one particular picture he sent me, which intrigued me, because I'd seen, I think I got these pictures from your blog, where we've got a very clear picture with Paul wearing spectacles pre-66, and he's looking off to the sort of towards the left in this picture, and you can clearly see that his earlobe is attached, his left earlobe is attached. And then there's another one, I think, of McCartney, I think when he was in, or Fall, I should say, when he was in Wings, I think it was that around that time where he's got the sort of mullety type hairstyle. And in that particular you can shot, you can see his left ear, and it's and the earlobe is clearly detached. But then my friend sent me this picture. I had seen it before. It's a clip from 1980 where he's given the news of John Lennon's death outside. He's in London, I think, going into a hotel or something. And you must be familiar with that clip, I'm sure.
Yes.
And then you see his, again, you see his left ear in that clip as well. But his earlobe appears to be attached again in that clip, which is odd. And I hadn't noticed that before. So, you know, have you noticed that these earlobes seem to do funny things, or, you know, in the various pictures, or?
Yes, and actually I have a blog post on that with lots of different pictures of the ears. And also we might be looking at photo tampering on some of these, where just a picture of Paul's ears superimposed on Paul's face.
And I think, you know, that brings us to sort of a general point, because, you know, a lot of people can say with a lot of the stuff that we research, oh, it's just Photoshop. You know, any image now, 9/11 image, you know, moon image or whatever, moon landing image, whatever it is, people who don't want to actually study this and go through all the evidence can just, oh, it's Photoshop, and, you know, walk on, you know, to the next thing and not really pay much attention. So on the one hand, you know, I was saying this to somebody as well, we can now do the image analysis. You know, we can put on a web page, particularly one of the things that's useful for doing these images is an animated GIF, you know, where you can actually, you know, switch one image on the page. I mean, you know, 10 years ago, you couldn't really do that. It was just so hard to do it on a computer, but now we can do that. So I think that's, you know, one of the other questions, we'll go through some more of the evidence, but I think one of the questions that comes up would be, well, if this really did happen, why has nobody found it out? Because if somebody has switched, you know, somebody's gonna know, you know. And I think now part of the reason why it's been becoming clearer is because we have the tools ourselves, you know, where we can actually do the image analysis ourselves. We don't have to go to a specialist photo lab, you know, and with a pair of scissors and everything, and get enlargements. You know, you think of the trouble of doing this with a real photographic image, getting a photograph to the exact size to match it with another one, you know, doing that on paper with chemicals and developers and stuff. And it's quite complicated. We can do it on a computer now in, you know, 5 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
So just as a general thing, I think now, you know, we have much greater analysis tools at our fingertips to be able to discover these hoaxes, which are all around us, basically. So we've looked at the ears, the mouth, a bit, the nose, and a bit about the jawline. And what about other factors with Paul's head? Is there anything else apart from the jawline that's been, you know, that's sort of come to light in that article or elsewhere?
Right. Well, the forensic scientist did mention that Paul's head was rounder in one of the pictures of Fall. Looked like it had been tampered to make it look like Fall's head was rounder. So on my blog, I have pictures of Fall from Sergeant Pepper, where there's one that looks just like a picture of Fall, where his head has not been tampered and his head is not round. And then there's a picture of Paul, whose head was very round. And then there's another picture of Fall from Sergeant Pepper that looks like a composite. So they used layers basically to merge the two together to make it look more like Paul.
To sort of smooth out the differences and kind of make it more, a bit like a morphing exercise that you can do now as well.
Yes.
Right.
So
okay.
This photo tampering to conceal the double, the photo tampering started immediately, already in the 60s.
Right.
They were doing this. So now this was not something that the forensic scientists talked about, but the height difference is pretty marked. An anonymous researcher sent me information where he had used the scale of instruments, such as the Hofner violin bass, which was a 30-inch scale, mm-hmm. Ringo's bass drum, which is 20-inch scale, and the English horn on the Sgt. Pepper album, which was a 31.14-inch scale. He used these instruments as a yardstick to determine that Paul was actually 5'7 to 5'8, although his official height is 5'11.
Right.
And he determined that Fall is about 2.5 inches taller, so in the 5'10 to 5'11 range. And we also have other people that are a reference point to compare the height. So you have Ringo, where Paul was just a little bit taller than Ringo, but Fall is a lot taller. Pretty obvious. And then you have the other Beatles. You have Paul's dad, where Paul a little bit taller, Fall is much taller. Then you have a picture of all the Beatles with Muhammad Ali, who was 6'2.5". So you can kind of tell where people's height range is. There's a picture of Fall with Brad Pitt, who was 5'11", and they look to be about the same height.
Right, so that, I mean, obviously you're cross-referencing quite a lot of images there, so we're not just really, you know, we're getting more into a sort of corroboration of different bits of evidence, because, you know, if you just go on one or two pictures, you can sort of, some people will try, you know, and I've had people said this to me already, you know, it's just the camera angle, you know, and if you, or the picture's been resized or something, you know, but you know, when you get more and more pictures where you, as you say, you've got people of known height, then you can make a much better judgment and corroborate that. So that's also, you know, piling on more anomalies, really, isn't it?
Yes, and some other people are Jane Asher, and who was Paul's fiance, I suppose, before the switch.
Right.
But so Anonymous, after he came up with this research, he predicted that there would be new full-length photos of Paul that would appear suddenly, and there were, and they basically revised Fall's height using the Hofner scale to make him seem shorter, but they miscalculated and actually put him in the 5'3 to 5'4 range. So
what's the Hofner scale? I'm not familiar with that.
Oh, the Hofner violin bass.
Oh, I see. Sorry.
Paul McCartney played. And one thing that happened to sort of conceal the difference was that Fall switched to using an Epiphone, which was 4 inches longer. So it makes the size ratios consistent.
I wasn't quite following you. So what you're saying is that what happened was when this anonymous researcher contacted you about these anomalies, following that, new archive images of Paul were released, yeah? That's what you're saying, it all came about.
Exactly.
They weren't like contemporary images of Fall. They were actually Beatles-era images of Fall, yeah?
Oh, no. They were a Fall of his current age.
Right, oh, I see.
But
right.
they were rescaled to make him seem shorter, but they made him too short.
Right, so they were contemporary images, but they'd been tampered with to make the modern Fall look the same height as Paul, yeah?
Yes, but they made him too small.
Yeah, they made him too small, right.
Right.
Yeah, I understand. So, well, I didn't quite follow you there, okay.
I apologize.
That's all right.
And so some things that the media does to conceal the difference is that they will show Fall playing piano or sitting down or with his feet or lower legs obscured, or having no instrument in hand, so there's no reference point to tell how tall he is. Just one of the media tricks. Mm. So another thing that has come up in the research is the dominant hand. So Paul was a famous left handed individual. He studied did everything with his left hand, and he even wrote backwards. He wrote everything back to front. He just couldn't cure himself of that. And then you see evidence of McCartney actually being right-handed. For example, in the anthology series, the video for I Will, they show Fall playing right-handed guitar in India. There is also a picture on Abbey Road. This was one of the clues that people locked onto, was that Fall was holding his cigarette in his right hand. Which doesn't really mean anything, but it's just it could be a clue. Another instance is Bettina Crispin. She sued McCartney for paternity, and she had a, in 1984, there was a paternity test and a lawsuit, and she came back in 2007 and said that McCartney had actually sent a double to the blood test. And one of the things she said was that the signature that accompanied the 1984 blood test was written by a right-handed person and not a left-handed person.
So just run that. I'm not familiar at all with that part of the story. So give the name of the lady tell us that story, because I don't know that story.
Okay, well, Bettina Crispin is the daughter of Erica Hubers. And Erica Huber said she had an affair with Paul McCartney in Hamburg from 1959 to 1962. And so she says that Bettina was her daughter. And in 1984, there was a paternity suit. McCartney, there was not a match between McCartney in 1984 and the daughter, Bettina, which is not surprising if it's not the original Paul.
So they actually did a DNA test then, did they?
Well, they did a blood test.
Blood test, of course. Yeah,
I'm not sure.
Yeah, right. I mean, they didn't have DNA testing in those days, did they? Or not as generally available as it is now.
Right. So that suit was dismissed in 1984. But in 2007, they tried to reopen it, or they did reopen the case, and this was in Germany, because she said she had gone back through the file, and the photograph that was with the blood test did not look like Paul. She said it was a lookalike, because Paul's face was rounder, it was fuller, and the person on the photo was, his face was not, it wasn't Paul. And so she was saying that he sent a stand-in. But I would say that Paul was the stand-in for Paul. So, anyway, that lawsuit didn't go anywhere, but just an interesting side note. So then researchers have also uncovered a difference in eye color. So Paul had brown eyes, although sometimes they appear to be hazel. But Fall has green eyes, and you can see his green eyes on the Strawberry Fields Forever video. They give you a very clear shot of it. And also in Fool on the Hill, you can see green eyes. Then another difference was the distance between the pupils. So if you set the scale, the distance between his pupils was 2.5 inches, whereas with Fall it was 2.62 inches. So bigger, taller guy, you'd expect bigger distance and different shaped eyebrows. There's also a different hair part. So Paul's hair parted from left to right, whereas Fall's parts from right to left. Then we have different voice prints. So the first person that I'm aware of to test the voice was Dr. Henry M. Truby from the University of Miami. In 1969, he analyzed 3 songs that Paul supposedly sang. So one was Yesterday, one was Penny Lane, and one was Hey Jude. And he came up with 3 different sonograms. So Yesterday, 1965, I would say definitely Paul. Penny Lane 1967, Hey Jude 1968. So those two were after the switch. So three different voices. I mean, voice prints are unique identifiers used to establish identity. So three different people.
Right,
singing.
Right. Is that, can that sort of voice print evidence be used in court in other cases then, or?
Well, they routinely use voice prints in court to establish identity. So it's like a fingerprint.
I didn't actually know that. I would not, you know, I didn't know for sure. I suspected it might be, but yeah, okay.
Yeah. So, so we don't know what happened with that. If there were, we have sound editing, which is like photo tampering to change how somebody sounds. So if they have somebody else singing, you can disguise their pitch in their voice and make them sound like a lower pitch. So if you, so now you can use computers to alter pitch and tempo, but back then the sound editors would use scissors, maybe two tape machines, a very speed control, and Sgt. Pepper, for example, the song She's Leaving Home, they slowed it down from the original mono version, which would make it sound like a lower pitch singer. And a lot of the original mono versions were deleted. So I don't know what that means. If it's Fall, sounds like he has a higher voice than Paul, if you listen to different recordings. So if you're slowing it down, it makes him sound like a lower pitched voice. So kind of disguise the voice. And they also use different methods, such as having other people sing with him, and also you can hear distortion on the voice sometimes. So that's
again, you know, I've noticed on, I think it's the, one of the sites does have these voice clips that you can listen to, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I did listen to them. I found it difficult because it's only like 1 second or something where they're comparing in 1 second clips, and I know that they've got to be careful because if they put the whole track on, you know, they can be done for, you know, copyright and so on. So you can't, you've really just got to get the tracks and listen to them yourself, really, haven't you, to sort of, you know, listen to that.
Well, some people have posted YouTube videos with the voice track isolated.
All right.
So you can listen to Paul on The Night Before, and he has a very good voice. And then if you listen to Fall on Back in the USSR, it's really quite shocking how, it doesn't sound so good, but I let people listen to that themselves, and those are posted on my blog.
Okay, and we didn't give out the address of the blog, and if you want to give that out.
Sure, it's plasticmaca.blogspot.com.
Yes, and I did smile when and sort of chuckle to myself when I saw that name. I think that's because he is called Macca over here. So you know, I think he's probably less common in the States that he's known as Macca, but over here it's like, oh, you know, there's old Macca on the telly again. You know, what's he doing these days? You know, and maybe we'll get on to what's he doing these days a bit in a few minutes. But yeah, so I mean, basically, to summarise all that, we've got a lot of differences. Physical differences and the voice print, the eye colour. So we're pretty much going beyond really this idea that it's just Photoshop or it's just this or just that. There really is something here. And again, I think, I was reading about the moon landing hoax few years ago now. Mm-hmm. And somebody was, you know, sort of arguing for the evidence. I mean, I know they never went to the moon. Now, I've absolutely no doubt in my mind about that at all now from various things that I've discovered. And then this person on the blog said, what do you think, they'd hoax it badly, you know, so that people could just tell straight away. In other words, whoever did this, they're pretty good at it. You know, they're obviously very good at it because they got away with it, and certainly, you know, 9/11, which I've done a lot of research into, and that's a huge, huge thing. And they got away with it. It's much bigger than Paul McCartney. Well, in some ways, I think it is. Affected more people directly And they got away with it, and they're still getting away with it, you know, 10 years after the event. So, you know, for people that are thinking that they can't do this, this would never work, somebody would find out. Well, they have found out, but
yes.
The people that have found out, nobody listens to them because, you know, they use all this media, spin, hype, propaganda and so on to keep it covered up.
Right.
So anyway, right. So we've covered a lot of the evidence there, and I think, oh yeah, there was one interesting thing which I think you mentioned in the other interview that you did in 2010. There was the incident where he got arrested for drug possession in Japan. I think that was, what was it, 1982?
1980,
right, okay. So yeah, I think somebody made a comment on your blog, and I was quite interested in your response to that, and we just go through that incident that he was... Was he going to a concert there? Was he visiting? Or maybe, I don't know if you know what he was doing there, but...
Right. It was for a concert. He went to Japan. He got detained for 10 days. And the official reason was because he had marijuana. But I think it was because the fingerprints didn't match from 1966 when Paul was there. And the marijuana charges were just a cover story that I think the Japanese were trying to figure out. Who was this person?
Yeah.
It's hard to find information on it. I've looked. There's really not much out there. So.
But yeah, it's quite a while ago, isn't it? I mean, I don't know whether it's, you know, was it routine in those days for the Japanese to take fingerprints, or, you know, was it just because he was a rock star and they knew he could be, you know, carrying drugs, so they fingerprinted him anyway or something, or?
It's possible.
Yeah, so we don't know all the details of that, but that's, again, an interesting sort of, side story, as it were.
Exactly.
Yeah. Which there are several. I mean, I hadn't heard the one about the, you know, the affair with the original Paul. I've not heard of that ever. So I'm interested that you, described that to us. So I think, again, you know, going back to the how could they have got away with it question. One of the obvious things, you know, you mentioned earlier on his father, for example. I mean, how, you know, let's just say Paul was indeed, you know, substituted with another chap. What are the family going to think? I mean, what do we know about what family has said or done or whatever? I mean, is there anything we know about that?
Well, as far as the family and friends go, probably first the people are convinced to go along with it, perhaps for national security, or you're doing it for your country, or whatever line they try to sell. And if that doesn't work, then there's bribery, there are threats, there's blackmail. They've already seen what happened to Paul, so that would be pretty convincing. So somebody can be disappeared and replaced and nobody's the wiser. That would probably convince me to keep my mouth shut. But people have spoken out. Ringo has said he was the last remaining Beatle. This was last year. And it's sort of pawned off as a joke. It says, Ringo said, I was in the biggest rock and roll band in the history of music. I am the last remaining Beatle.
When did you say that? What was there an interview or?
Yes, it was May 2011.
Wow.
So then the article says the best jokes are based on truth. Ringo says there is an element of truth in it.
Wow. Because Ringo's kept a pretty low profile, hasn't he? Since I think the last thing he did in this country was a children's television series commentary. We have a children's television series called Thomas the Tank Engine. And
right.
he did the commentary for that. I mean, maybe you're familiar with that from your research, but he's kept a very low profile over here, as far as I'm aware. I mean, my brother's an expert on the Beatles, and you know, he sort of brought me up on the Beatles, actually, to be honest with you, which is again why I'm interested in this. My brother's been to see Paul McCartney several times in concert, you know, in more recent years and stuff, and he got all the Beatles records and. He got me a Beatles anthology book for my birthday and stuff a few years ago, and so he's well into it all. But yeah, I mean, Ringo, what, do you know what Ringo's done apart from this interview? Has he done much? I mean, he's, you know, has he done any sort of new recordings or anything?
Not that I'm aware of.
No. Sorry, carry on.
Oh, okay. Well, I just wanted to go through sort of the whistleblowers.
Okay.
Mal Evans, his story, he had a tragic story. He was the road manager for 10 years. He was the Beatles' road manager. And he kept a series of diaries chronicling those times. And in November 1975, he claimed on a radio show that he had co-written songs on Sgt. Pepper, such as Fixing a Hole and Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. So he wrote those with McCartney. And unfortunately, he didn't receive any royalties, even though they were promised to him, according to his interview. And in 1976, he planned to publish a tell-all book based on his diaries, and he was going to call it Living the Beatles Legend, and it was going to be published by Grosset and Dunlop. About a week before, he was going to take this book to the publishers on January 5th, 1976. He was shot to death by Los Angeles police, and earlier that day, he had contacted his collaborator, John Herney, I hope I'm saying that name right, to make sure that the book got finished and got published. But after he was shot, his book, the suitcase, and even his body were lost. His ashes were lost in the mail. The police lost the book. Only portions of it have ever been published. The suitcase that was full of Beatles recordings and photos and memorabilia was lost, and it has never resurfaced. And on the way back to England, his ashes were lost, and so that's a pretty suspicious story. And I tried to get information, and I just got the runaround. So when I asked, I filed a FOIA request. I asked for information. I had to prove he was dead. I proved he was dead, and then they came back and asked for him to sign off on the request. So that was kind of funny. And so then Heather Mills is another one I think was almost about to spill the beans on McCartney. She gave an interview during the divorce to Access Hollywood to Billy Bush, and during that interview she said, "You know why I've left you, protect me, and I will say nothing." She said something so awful happened that was beyond belief. Someone she loved betrayed her immensely, and it wasn't infidelity. And she said that people don't want to know the truth because they could never handle it. They would be too devastated. So then apparently she got death threats. She said she has a box of evidence that she gave to someone, and if anything happened to her, if she were to be topped off, that box of evidence would come out, and the truth would come out. She said that there is so much fear from a certain party of the truth coming out that lots of things have been done, and she said the police warned her that she'd been getting serious death threats from an underground movement. So,
right, and I mean that, you know, I saw some of that a couple of years ago, some of the interviews after this had gone through the press, because for somebody like me, when I see that sort of news in the press, I'm put off by it, because to me it's like gossip, you know. And so I heard all the Heather Mills stuff, and I just thought, well, that's just going to be, you know, celeb gossip, so I'm not really going to listen to it. And I think it was only 2 or 3 years after it had all sort of gone through the press that I was, you know, came across the other, well, I'd like to talk about that other site, actually, with all the animated GIFs. I came across that site, and then I went to the YouTube and looked at the Heather Mills interviews, and she was sort of going on to one of the UK shows to respond to the character assassination that she'd undergone in the UK press. And it was at that point that I realised what the press were doing to her was, you know, at the very least, introducing doubts about her, and the sort of any normal person seeing it would realize that it was character assassination, you know, way over the top. and she wasn't, I think they tried to portray that she was trying to extort all the money from Paul, which when you listen to this interview, that wasn't what she was talking about. So when people come out with this sort of language, such as you were describing, being threatened and so on, and having this evidence as to what's going on, it does make you wonder as to what's behind that.
So. Right, so if they discredit her, and if she were to say something, then nobody would believe her anyway, so.
Right.
It's just one of those tactics. They use against their enemies. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, and I think, talking about those that were close to Paul, I mean, we have a few other people like Brian Epstein, for example. Was the official story that he committed suicide? I can't remember now.
Drug overdose.
Drug overdose, right.
That was 1967, and so was that because he was close to them? He didn't want to play that game? Were they afraid he'd reveal something? I don't know.
Well, that's it. I mean, we can only speculate on those issues, can't we? Whereas any of the other things we've got more evidence for, but it is peculiar that somebody quite close to the Beatles died around the same time as this seemed to have happened, basically. Okay, yeah, so there was another thing that came up on this other interview I did, because I did this other interview a few weeks ago where this topic came up, and it was the producer who was recording things. He came out with some of the things that you'd mentioned, and he also said that he thought that Jimi Hendrix had been, that was why he was, suicided or whatever, because he got to know. What have you had any information on that, or thoughts on that, or other musicians that, you suspect from what you've come across might have twigged or, something?
Well, as far as I know, Jimi Hendrix's manager has been identified as having killed him. And I don't remember if that was an admission. Brian Jones from the Rolling Stones, supposedly a contractor, killed him. Very interesting is Mama Cass and Keith Moon both died in Harry Nilsson's London flat. They were both 32 years old, 4 years apart. And so they live a dangerous life, because there's a long list of people who have died. I mean, David McGowan has written about the Laurel Canyon Hollywood scene inside the LC, and has sort of chronicled the deaths of many stars and celebrities.
Can you just tell us who David McGowan is again?
He's an author. Right. He's an author. He wrote Program to Kill.
Oh, okay.
And you would probably be interested in his series called Wagging the Moon Doggy, where he talks about the fake alien, the fake moon landing, how it was a hoax, and he brings up a lot of good points.
Oh, good. Yeah, sounds very interesting. That's,
it is.
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay. I was thinking there, for example, I think, when you get people starting to become very popular or having influence, they essentially need to be handled in some way. They need to have handlers. And the sort of environment that Keith Moon was ending up in, and the name, I forget the name of the flat, the guy's flat that you mentioned there that he died in.
Harry Nilsson.
Mm-hmm. What I was thinking was, he could be some kind of handler or, person that, he gets involved with these celebrities, he keeps tabs on them, and if they're about to step out of line, he can report back, because we've experienced this with this Jim Fetzer character. I'm pretty sure that Jim Fetzer is a handler. He was basically, for a time, he was my handler, as much as you can do it through the internet. But we sussed him out eventually. I might edit this bit out, but I've written an article about this, so that's not a secret. And I'll come on to this a bit later. I think we've been through a couple of other questions here, like Yoko and stuff. But the way that it's handled on the internet, in the forums, which is really weird. I want to come on to that in a bit. Okay, so right, so we've done Brian Epstein, Jimi Hendrix we've talked about. And then I think if we go on to Yoko Ono and John Lennon and maybe cover that side of things a bit, because I don't know. I mean, so Yoko Ono, what, tell me a bit more about, let's go on to that. So Yoko Ono then, I mean, she came into the Beatles, didn't she? What year did she come into the Beatles? I can't remember.
Oh, I believe that was, well, that was 1966. I want to say it was September 11th, even.
Really?
But I could be wrong on that, but her background is very interesting because she was pawned off on people as being an artist who just happens to meet the Beatles. But her background, she's from a Japanese elite banking family. She has ties to the royal family. She went to school for royalty. I think she was a plant. I think she was meant to be controlled opposition to derail the peace movement, because what she did was she discredited the peace protesters, and she was giving interviews sitting in a bag trying to talk about how important it was to protest the Vietnam War, but it looked like a Monty Python interview.
Right, so just, this was sort of before the Happy Christmas War is Over side of things. This was in the late 60s, was it? Or
Right. So they had the bed-ins and the having naked pictures of themselves and just making it look ridiculous, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think some of that actually didn't, probably backfired on them a bit, because I mean, for somebody like me, Lennon sort of turning it into I think the bag on the head is a bit stupid, but, you know, the bedding and things, I think was actually sort of more dangerous. In other words, you know, telling people just not to protest, just be peaceful. I think that's actually quite a dangerous idea myself. It might sound strange, but, I've talked about this in other things that I've, you know, talks I've done and stuff, but that is quite interesting. Obviously, with Yoko Ono's background, I think, and I'd heard a long time ago that she was actually sent in to kind of, you know, just get involved with the Beatles somehow. Mm-hmm. That was her job, and mm-hmm. Of course, she ends up marrying John, and he himself, I know, I've heard him on interviews. He said that a few years into the marriage, she actually said to him, "Oh, go and have an affair with somebody, John." And that there was another person, I think it was their housekeeper or something, or their nanny or something, and apparently John Lennon had an affair with her because Yoko Ono told him to. Have you heard this interview?
Was it Mei Peng?
That's her, Mei Peng, yeah.
Yeah, he was gone for about a year, as far as I know, in California.
Yeah.
And then he came back, but... Now I remember reading that the Beatles, after they made it big, they didn't let new people into their group.
Right, right.
And so how would this woman come in? And did you see John Lennon's first wife, Cynthia Lennon? She was a blonde bombshell.
Right.
And he had a young son. It's just...
Yeah, he did. That's right. And I remember, again, I saw a documentary a few years ago about that. And... It was Julian Lennon, Julian, his son by Cynthia, wasn't he?
Yes.
Julian was 17 when John Lennon was shot, and John Lennon lost his father when John was 17. So there was a synchronicity there of sorts, which was rather tragic.
I was just going to say another interesting synchronicity about the shooting was that in the Magical Mystery Tour movie, you see a picture of John with a sign called "The Best Way to Go is by MD&C. And Mark David Chapman was the assassin in 1980.
Oh, wow.
And it was 13 years to the day after Magical Mystery Tour was released.
Yeah, I mean, you get into some of these numerology things, and it's very, very strange. Very strange.
Yes.
Very strange. And I think, you know, we don't want to go off into the John Lennon thing too much.
No.
Yeah, it's a very, very interesting documentary, and I forget what was exactly what I was going to say about that now. But, oh yeah, I know what. You know, basically they tried to get John Lennon deported in the 70s. The Nixon administration hated him. And they tried to get him deported. And then eventually they gave him a green card. And he was living with Yoko. He had Sean. I think Sean was born, I think, 1975, 76 or something like that. And they lived in New York, had a happy family life. And, of course, Lennon was shot in 1980. And I think it was about 2 weeks after Reagan had been elected.
So and it was right after the Playboy interview where he said that LSD had been invented to control people.
Really?
The government, yeah.
CIA. I'll have to listen to that if I can get a hold of that. So, but I think it was interesting because, you know, the Nixon administration hated him. The Carter administration obviously finished. And then to me it looks like they thought, right, this Lennon character is too much of a wild cannon. We've got to get him out of the way because we've got all this war agenda coming in with the Reagan administration, you know. And let's get him out of the way so we can just get on with that and we don't have to worry about it. That's just my idea, you know, I've not seen that written anywhere, but.
Well, that was Fenton Bresler's thesis in The Murder of John Lennon.
Was it?
Yes.
Well, I've never even read that, so, you know.
Right. It basically said that with the incoming Reagan administration that they wanted to get rid of John Lennon.
Ah, okay. So. That's all. I've come up with the same thought independently.
Pretty
whatever
much.
It's worth. okay, well, I mean, we'll digress in a bit, but let's go back to some of the other things surrounding Fall. And just a couple of things I'd like to cover. The interview that I did, this chap, he mentioned that Paul had been killed in a car crash. The story that he'd heard, very, very briefly was that, because I know you don't think this is true, that John Lennon and Paul McCartney had an argument, and Paul went out in his car, just drove off in a huff or whatever, and then he had a car accident, and the car was quite a bad crash, and Paul lost his head in the crash or something. And tell us your thoughts about that side of things and what you actually think happened to the original Paul.
Right. Well, that was the first story that was. In 1969, when the Paul is dead story broke, the car crash story was what Fred LaBour wrote about. That was his idea. And so this idea that it was an accident has been floating around for many years. But based on the fact that it takes time to find and train a double, and based on my research, pinpointing the date of replacement being between August 25th and August 28th, 1966, I highly doubt that it was an accident. It might have been a staged car crash. It might be one level of the disinformation in case people start to dig deeper, then they think it's an accident. Well, that's better than somebody being murdered and replaced. But basically Paul was, the last time I saw Paul was August 25th, 1966 in Seattle. And I don't mean literally see him, but pictures of him. So then they went to LA 2 days off, August 26th, August 27th, and then they reappear August 28th at the LA press conference. And that is, in my opinion, not Paul anymore. But the replacement, his first appearance as Paul. So that's a 2-3 day window to have a replacement step into his shoes. There's no way. If it had been an accident, there's no way they would have had somebody prepared. That person had been prepared in advance.
Now, on that sort of theme of things, you know, can you tell us if there's like other YouTube videos of like that, you know, press conference? Or audios of it, so, you know, can
oh,
we?
Oh, sure.
Right.
It's on YouTube.
Okay. And so we could go and watch those videos of the before and after, and, you know, what I'm interested in is looking at the other, members of the groups, you know, air reaction, how much they say, whether they're the same level of jokiness that they always were, mm-hmm. or whether there's kind of a more restrained, you know, or dampened down feel. I mean, certainly if you look at the, and I don't want to dive off onto the moon landings too much, but if you look at that press conference they gave after they come back from the moon, you can clearly see that those are not, these are not happy bunnies. That are at that press conference. So I'm looking at it more, you know, if you'd notice things like that in the videos that you hear anything or.
Well, two good interviews to compare are the August 19, 1966 Memphis interview, which is definitely Paul. Then the August 28, 1966, which I think is Fall. And interesting about that interview is David Crosby is hanging around in the background. And David Crosby has Illuminati ties, and that is detailed in David McGowan's Inside the LC series.
Now that brings me on to another question then in relation to that, which is, wasn't he the one who talked about the JFK assassination in his concerts or something? Wasn't that David Crosby?
I'm not sure about
okay.
that.
Okay, maybe I'm getting that mixed up with somebody else. Okay, so those two interviews then, I think what we'll do is we'll make links to those. I'll get the links to those and link those up. So those are two key interviews to watch so that we can compare the, sort of the mannerisms and so on, and that would be interesting to compare those.
Yes.
And that's one of the key bits of evidence you would say then from your research. That leads you to this date, this fairly sort of narrow sort of date range there.
Yes, and also because pictures of the Seattle concert have been recycled and portrayed as being from the Candlestick Show, which was the last concert. And very interesting about the very last Beatles concert, one would think it would be hyped beyond all reasonableness, but it has actually been suppressed. And it was, from all accounts, not a good concert, a disaster even, so.
Why was that? I mean, again, you know, in my knowledge of the Beatles, which isn't, you know, that extensive, but I think I mentioned in the email, my knowledge was that their last concert wasn't a concert. It was the impromptu setup on the roof of Abbey Road Studios. But mm-hmm. you know, now you mention that, if I was to think, well, what was the concert before mm-hmm. that they did, I wouldn't even be able to tell you. You know, and you're now telling me that the last concert was where it was.
The last concert was Candlestick Park in San Francisco, and I want to say it was August 29th or August 30th, 1966. I forget the exact date.
And that you sort of saying that was a disaster. What was? Oh, maybe that's, you know.
Probably because it wasn't Paul.
Okay.
So you have concerts like Shea Stadium, which are hyped, and you can see that they're great concerts. And then you have the very last Beatles concert, and I'm not counting the Twickenham Studios impromptu Let It Be.
Yeah,
so.
Okay. I mean, again, that right there, I mean, that's something that is really key, because, again, if we can get a video of that, the Candlewick concert, is that on YouTube, do you know, or is it, can you get a DVD of it or something these days, or?
It's Candlestick, but yeah, it should be on YouTube, and yeah.
So, I mean, again, you know, if people want to watch that, this is something they can really grab a hold of and say, well, what's going on here, you know, and come to the whatever conclusion they come to, surely.
Yes.
Good, excellent. Okay, so the other thing I wanted to just mention, I think there's sort of covering most things I wanted to, plus a few more, which is great. But the other thing which I'd come across was on one page, they were talking about, so we've got to ask the question, okay, right, so somebody stepped into Paul's shoes, and they were pretty reasonably good at it, good enough that they got away with it, basically, with a bit of massaging in the media and so on,
mm-hmm.
And threats and bumping off a few people. So there was several names that have come up in what I've read about this. In fact, I think it was that, brings me back to that other website. There's the one I'm looking at is the digilander.libero.it.
Right, that was the first one I came across when I started looking into it.
Do you know who created that then?
Well, I mean, he goes by the name Sun King, and he's from Italy, and he started the King is Naked forum, which I think he's lost control of now, but he's an old timer, basically.
Okay, yeah, I mean, this is the one that I came across, and it is very thorough, and you can clearly see, you know, barring a few misprints and typos in the description, you know, this to me was what convinced me that Paul had indeed been replaced. Mm-hmm. This looking at these animated GIFs and so on that he's put together, very thorough job, very mm-hmm. evidence based. This convinced me. But I think it's let me just see if it's on this page, if I get this right. Is it on this site where Phil Acryl is brought up as?
It could be. Phil Acryl, he's been floating around as a potential Paul for years. I personally don't think anybody famous became Paul. I know there was a 1965 Paul McCartney lookalike contest. Keith Ellison was the official winner. I happen to think that it was used to recruit the replacement, but this person would never have shown up on the radar. He probably was never even an official contestant. And I suspect that this person died in a terrible tragic accident and then became Paul.
Right. So in other words, that brings us to one of the other questions, doesn't it? That the double had to essentially die, or, you know, fake his own death or have his death faked for him.
Mm-hmm.
To take on the role of Paul.
Exactly.
So this again is, these are the things that are really difficult for people to sort of digest, aren't they? Because it would be so unusual for anybody to do that. But, of course, if you look at it from the double's point of view, if they went up to this guy, the Secret Services or whoever did this and said, well, what you're going to have is, you know, a life of luxury. You can have anything you want, go anywhere in the world that you like. And all you've got to do is pretend that you die. It's not a difficult choice, is it?
You know,
if they do everything else for you, and they're obviously going to do a good job. So it's not Phil Acryl. So the William Campbell name came up, and tell us more about that.
William Campbell's name has been connected to the Ontario Provincial Police. Apparently he worked there in 1966, and on the Sergeant Pepper cover, Fall is wearing the OPP patch for the Ontario Provincial Police patch, but it was tampered to make it look like OPD, which stands for officially pronounced dead. And then Fall also lived in Campbelltown, Scotland. So that was another connection that people have. And also there's a back mask track that says I was William Campbell. That's from the Gratitude song.
Gratitude song. What?
So you can. There's a song. It's on YouTube. It says Gratitude Clue, and it's a back mask song that says I was William Campbell. So that's sort of where that name came from. But Billy Shears is another one. So William Shears, but that could be an allusion to William Shakespeare, who was actually, it was an alias for Sir Francis Bacon. So.
Yeah, that's another thing I was listening to. I was listening to, forget the name, somebody on Red Ice Radio that did an interview. I forget his name now, I should remember it. But he was going through that evidence, you know, like Shakespeare. We haven't got any handwritten manuscripts from many of the Shakespeare's plays, you know, and I thought, that's a good basis for English literature lessons that we have here, isn't it? You know, you know, no actual handwritten manuscripts of any Shakespeare plays, you know, surviving.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, apparently that's true. Hmm. So Billy Shears might be a reference to William Shakespeare, which then mm-hmm. might be another clue as to the other fakery that went on, you know, in the Middle Ages and so on.
Nice.
Okay. Alrighty. So I think we've covered most of that now. So, but then the thing we haven't covered is the motive for doing this. I mean, you know, this is the other big people immediately go to the motive. That's what we found with 9/11. You know, they say, well, why is the US government going to murder its own people? In fact, well, it's not necessarily the US government that's done it.
Right.
Initially, you know, that's what I'd say. But so what was the motive for murdering Paul and putting in this double? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, if you think about the world stage that the Beatles commanded, and Paul was the leader at that point, mid-1966, he was calling the shots. They began speaking out against the Vietnam War. So if people listen to that Memphis interview, they'll be saying that they're speaking out against the war, saying that if people don't want to fight, they shouldn't have to, and it could really undermine the war effort, especially when they were trying to ramp up the war. The Beatles were critical of government. I mean, if you listen to Taxman, that's pretty harsh criticism of the tax system. I also think that they were exposing satanic ritual abuse on the Butcher album. Paul pushed really hard for that album. It was Yesterday and Today. It came out, it had the Beatles in white smocks with baby dolls decapitated and blood and meat and just really gross, and it doesn't make any sense unless you think, well, is there a message in that? And what was the message?
Yeah, that's it. This is where you've got to stop and look at that. I mean, I remember hearing about that controversy. I think my brother told me about it. And I saw some pictures in a magazine or something, and this was probably in the late 70s, early 80s when my brother was showing me all this stuff. And you've got to, yeah, now looking back on that, you've got to think, why, what were they trying to say there? What were they doing? It really is a good question. And, you know, yeah, if they were trying to expose this ring of abuse, because obviously by that time they were going to be rubbing shoulders with some of the sort of, you know, high members in high society and so on, weren't they? So, you know, there's a potential for them to actually discover some of the sort of nefarious goings on within those circles.
Right. And people like Kubrick, when they expose secrets like in Eyes Wide Shut, they end up dead. Rick Clay, another one who gave his famous Red Eyes radio interview and committed suicide 4 days later.
Right.
So I've also linked it to the MKUltra LSD agenda as a potential motive, because, well, celebrities wield a lot of influence, and they can be used for promotional reasons. They use them in advertising, and I think that they were using celebrities as real life promotional advertisers. They had Paul was reserved in his drug use. I'm not saying he never did drugs, but he was limited. In his Hamburg days, he took 1 to 2 pralines, where the others would take like 4 or 5. He outright refused to take heroin, according to Dick Lester, even though 2 beautiful women were trying to convince him to do it. He said in a 1965 interview with Melody Maker that he did not want to influence his fans to drink or not drink or to smoke or not smoke. That wasn't their place to do that. On the other hand, Fall was the first British pop star to openly talk about taking LSD. He talked about an interview with Queen Magazine, 1967, and then ITN followed up in an interview where he talked about LSD, and that really influenced a lot of people to try it. And people, I wasn't around at that time, but George Harrison said after that interview, the whole world went crazy, people taking LSD. People I've spoken to personally said that influenced them to try it. So sort of like using Paul as a vehicle, like using his influence, his popularity to get people to try this psychochemical warfare agent. So then you have to go into LSD, and what were they trying to accomplish with that?
Well, this is where it links, you know, again, I think aspects of the musical themes. You know, I think you mentioned that in the email, and the whole character of the music changed, sort of at Sergeant Pepper and then beyond.
Yes.
And I think that and the thing that you were just talking about with the LSD, that those are both aspects of consciousness as I see it. And,
right.
And, you know, and shifting that sort of whole scenario in a negative way.
Right. So Dr. Timothy Leary, who is very well known for promoting LSD, he admitted to W.H. Bowertz that he was a CIA asset, that he was actually recruited to help promote the usage. And he said that, and he was talking about Sgt. Pepper, since you mentioned that. He said the Sgt. Pepper album compresses the evolutionary development of musicology and much of the history of Eastern and Western sound in a new tympanic complexity. Then adds psychedelic drugs. Millions of kids turned on pharmacologically listening to stoned-out electronic music designed specifically for the suggestible psychedelized nervous system by stoned-out long-haired minstrels. This is the most powerful brainwashing device our planet has ever known. Indeed, if you were an observer from a more highly evolved planet wondering how to change human psychology and human cultural development, would you not inevitably combine electrical energies from outside with biochemical catalysts inside to accomplish your mutation?
Wow, that's incredible. And where was that from again?
Okay, it was from his Thank God for the Beatles essay to Dr. Timothy Leary. So they were using music and LSD as a brainwashing device. They were used to induce mental confusion and helplessness in people to make them easier to control and manipulate.
Yeah.
So even if so it's a mind control experiment, but it also diverted attention away from the Vietnam War. So it was derailing the peace movement because the hippies, quote, were too busy turning on, tuning in, and dropping out to effectively resist the war machine. So the anti-war movement was rendered impotent.
Yeah, so I mean, I think, again, looking at some of these other issues, that's where you're going to find the motive. You know, it's not just, the motive isn't a simplistic one. It's more complicated than that, and that's where you have to start looking at some of the social issues, you know, and the psychological issues and so on. And unless you actually understand that there is this secret apparatus operating, then, you know, you're not really going to understand the way the motive, you know, comes about.
Right. And Vladimir Lenin once said one quick way to destroy a society is through its music. And then you have Fall talking about Helter Skelter and how he purposely degraded that song. So the music was changing if you listen to... Well, there's a marked delineation between Paul's music and Fall's music. So before the switch and after the switch, although there's some bleed over because I do think they use Paul's songs later, his voice even, because they had recordings of it or his bass lines, and so it makes it hard to really, with the music, it's harder to...
Just if you use that alone, it's harder to detect, isn't it? And I mean, they couldn't just switch it, you know. I mean, there were several reasons. You know, they couldn't just switch it because it would be blatantly obvious, and of course we had the other band members who wouldn't have gone along with it probably if it totally changed the music to, you know, just some harsh, heavy rock, you know, sort of music. They had to sort of smooth it and change it.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously you do see that, you know, in between, if you look at, go to the album before Sgt. Pepper's, which was that Rubber Soul, was it?
Or Revolver.
Revolver, wasn't it? Yeah. And if you go from there to the White Album, you can see that there is a sort of transition through Sgt. Pepper's, so that makes it smoother. Oh, I'm just sort of, from my own view of that, you know, I'm not an expert on this, but that's what it sounds like to me anyway.
Right, exactly.
Okay. Is there anything you wanted to add to that bit? Because we've got just a couple of other things, I think, to cover now. Maybe one even.
Well, you had said you wanted to talk about some of the song lyrics and
some of the clues.
Well, basically, about 400 clues have been found for Paul is Dead, and I'm not even sure that that counts the physiological differences. I think this is just song, backmass songs or clues on album covers, and I don't even know that I found all 400, but so people have talked about some of the songs that came up as being references to Paul is Dead. So one of them was the black carnation that McCartney was wearing on the Magical Mystery Tour in the segment For Your Mother Should Know. So the black carnation has been seen as a symbol of death. And McCartney said, "I was wearing a black flower because they ran out of red ones." But another researcher named Brian Moriarty, he called BS on that, basically saying why Paul believed they had run out of red flowers when the movie clearly showed him being handed a substantial bouquet of red flowers and then dancing around the room with them during the same scene in which he alone stubbornly continues to wear the black one. Are we really supposed to believe that Paul McCartney, the director of the movie, could not have obtained a matching flower to wear in the scene if he really wanted to? So another song that has come up is Strawberry Fields Forever. And at the very end, it says, "I buried Paul." And John Lennon supposedly said he was saying cranberry sauce. But if you listen closely, it doesn't sound like cranberry sauce. It sounds like "I buried Paul." So I think that's what he said. Revolution number 9, when it's played backwards, it sounds like a fiery car crash. And then the part where it says number 9, it actually, when it's played backwards, says "turn me on, dead man, turn me on, dead man." At the end of "I'm the Walrus," they let a radio show of King Lear play. And that scene is about untimely death. Oh, untimely death. So that's another death clue. In the song "Blue Jay Way," it says Paul is bloody. And "I'm so tired," when it's fast, well, it says Paul is dead man, miss him, miss him, miss him.
That's when you play it backwards, or parts of it.
Right. And okay. So Terry Knight actually is another interesting. He sang the song "St. Paul," which was dedicated to McCartney and seems to be another PID song. It was released 5 months before the rumor of McCartney's death came out. So it was released on May 19th, 1969. He had a modest hit with it. And so "St. Paul" has been linked to St. Paul of Tarsus, possibly, who was beheaded. So another possible head injury situation. It was not published by Knight's publishing company, Storybook Music, but rather by Macklin Music, which only publishes Lennon and McCartney songs. So it seems possible that McCartney actually commissioned the song for him to record. So that's why it's published by Macklin Music. But Knight was murdered in 2004, and he never discussed the song or anything about it, really, unfortunately. So.
On and on it goes. Yeah, so.
There are tons of clue songs.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, one of the things that intrigued me, and I'd mentioned this in the email, was the song "I'm Looking Through You." And if you listen to the lyrics in that, they're very strange. "I thought I knew you, what did I know? You don't look different, but you have changed." But then, of course, this was on the Rubber Soul album, which was released in 65.
Right.
You look at that there and you think, well, that's obviously puts that theory to bed about these clues in the songs, because this was before the switch. But then we talked about this idea that, we do seem to get strange foreboding of certain events happening. I mean, the classic example that I tell people about, which you may already be aware of, is the novel that was published, I think it was in 1897, and it was by a French guy, I can't remember the name. The novel, I can't remember the name of the novel either, but it was about a ship. It was about a ship that was 20,000 tons, and it was called the SS Titan, and it hit an iceberg on its maiden voyage from New York to London, and many or all of the passengers died because there weren't enough lifeboats, and that novel was published in 1897. So,
about the Titanic. Well, if anything about
The ship was called the SS Titan.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So, you know, either, you know, you can argue that two ways. You know, one is that it was an amazing prophetic novel that you, again, you can find a webpage which lists the comparison between the SS Titan and the, which was fictitious, and the Titanic. And, then you can go into the idea that the people that are doing these things, I think, as I've come to understand it, one of the rules of the occult game, which is what's behind a lot of this stuff, which, again, people just don't believe such things go on, but the occult, you know, sort of activities are real. I'm convinced of that. I don't understand all of them. I don't understand all the details, but they are real as far as I've been able to tell, and they do go on. And one of the rules of the game appears to be that they have to give us clues. They have to tell us what they're doing in some overt way or covert way, and perhaps we get these clues coming even you know, it sounds weird to say it, but even coming through time. And I don't. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that side of things?
Well, I have considered that too. That either they're outing certain things, the replacement agenda. I would say that the Who substitute might be another example of that, because it was looked at as a Clue song, but then it was released before the replacement, so we thought, well, no, but it could be revealing a doubles agenda. It could also be that future events impact the present. I mean, Revolver is an interesting name for an album, considering that I personally think that Paul was shot in the head, execution style, based on reverse speech, basically, and different clues, such as in Condensed Cream of the Beatles. I think the imagery that they do let you know what happens, but you have to know how to read the symbols. So that's just my personal opinion, and I was saying he definitely was shot in the head. I know people have different opinions about what happened, but it's just what I think happened. So if that's true, then Revolver, is that some sort of future event leaving an imprint somehow?
Sure, we don't know, do we? We can't really possibly prove that. But again, obviously people would say, well, a revolver means a record that goes round, which is a bit old-fashioned mm-hmm. these days. You know, that would be the obvious one that people would go to there, I suppose. Okay, but I think certainly the song lyrics themselves are very interesting to sort of consider. They certainly grabbed my attention once I'd sort of caught on to some of these bits of evidence that we've discussed. And the other thing, just briefly, you know, I want to go onto the internet forums in a minute, because that's one of my sort of pet things that I've written about. But the other thing is just to mention as a tie-in with Michael Jackson, because of course Michael Jackson and Fall developed a relationship, didn't they, in the 80s, and that whole story of Michael Jackson seems to be another strand of this thing, you know, and maybe just offer any thoughts you might have on that, if you've got any.
Well, I think Michael Jackson, I think they were testing the limits of what people would accept in a replacement.
Really?
Because if you look at him, he was a nice looking African American, normal looking, and then at the end he was basically white and had extreme surgery. That was the story. And I heard different stories about why his skin was white, because originally it was a disease and then it was skin bleaching. So, but there have been pictures that there's an Egyptian statue that looks a lot like Michael Jackson, so I don't know if that's...
It makes you wonder, doesn't it? I mean, again, we're going off into some very sort of tricky areas, but yeah, you know, there's something weird going on there.
Well, the Luciferian cult, are they drawing a comparison between the people that they worship and are they trying to model these stars after these quote gods that they have?
yeah, set up these idols for us to worship.
Right.
It's that same sort of mentality, isn't it, that they had in pharaonic times and so on. There seems to be something in that. And a lot of this symbolism and stuff seems to go back to ancient Egypt, doesn't it? I mean,
yes.
A lot of people seem to have established that in various ways. Right. Well, before we, just finally, I think the thing that did come up on your blog, I think, and I know that this, cause you'd lost a lot of information, didn't you? Cause you set up a forum, didn't you, to discuss all of this?
Well, I didn't set up the forum, but I inherited it. The forum, master basically just didn't have time to keep up with it. So she gave it over to me, and unfortunately, I wasn't getting any messages from pro boards about whatever issues they had, and they took it down, and I tried to tell them that I was a moderator and I would fix any information or content that they didn't like, but they wouldn't communicate with me about it. So it's down. I know some people have been trying to get it back up, but I was able to salvage a lot of the most critical information off of it, but it was 5 years worth of work that people had been putting on there. So there was no way to save all of it. So it was disappointing to try to get all that information back together. But I know you were interested in sort of the disinformation agents and the opposition that we've encountered. And when I first got into the research, I thought, oh, people, when they see the evidence, they'll believe it or they'll want to. I wasn't expecting to get the opposition that I did. I didn't realize that they had agents who were paid to sit on these forums, and anytime you post that they're going to send their whole day debunking whatever you post and put so much time and effort into tampering with photos. And so basically it revealed that people are using multiple aliases, and they come back and they will sign up with a different name and they'll support their other alias, and they make it seem like they have a lot more support for their position than they really do. So then a couple of years later, it actually was revealed that the government, military will have paid agents that use multiple aliases. So.
Right.
But I caught them. I caught them because they would use the same signature. And it wasn't like a famous quote or something that multiple people might be interested in using, but something fairly obscure. So it's like, oh, that's the same guy.
That's it. I mean, it is bizarre, and it's almost otherworldly, I think, because I just mentioned some of my own experiences with the 9/11 research. And at one point, you know, me being from a software background, I actually wondered, looking at how far we've come with natural language analysis and this sort of thing, I wondered if some of these posters were even real people. And, you know, I wondered if, for example, we had some sophisticated black ops software system which could actually, you know, read a forum post, break it down grammatically, and generate a reply. Because, you know, in some ways, there seemed to be so much traffic and so many posts from particular posters, you began to wonder where they actually had the time to do it. And, you know, and particularly when you mention, for example, the, you know, editing photos and stuff. And this stuff takes time.
Mm-hmm.
And you do, you know, when you, you know, if you're like me and you're just trying to sort of show the most compelling evidence, you just get overwhelmed because these people seem to have all the time in the world. They can make five posts to your one post, and again, maybe using multiple aliases. And in the end, it just seems worthless because what I found is that any useful content that you've posted, you know, whatever arguments you've distilled down to, you know, the most compelling issues, that just gets completely diluted and destroyed by these anonymous posters. And certainly speaking for myself, that's one reason why whenever I go onto a forum now, I always use my real name. I never use an alias because I can then basically just say to these people, well, you're just anonymous. You know, what have you done? You don't even use your real name. And I'm not saying that everyone feels comfortable doing this, but this is kind of like a sort of policy decision that I decided to make myself more powerful, because I said, look, I'm not afraid of you. I'm not afraid to speak the truth. If you can't even tell me, you know, a little bit about yourself and why you're doing this, why you're spending this much time here, then frankly, I think your whatever you post is irrelevant. It doesn't have any relevance whatsoever, because, you know, and then when you can demonstrate these people are lying, you know.
Right. And they inevitably find out who you are anyway. And I have had my picture posted on forums, my house. I've had my career threatened.
Wow.
So they try to intimidate you. Okay, we know who you are. It's like, well, what are you going to do about it?
Good. Well, I'm glad that you said that, because, you know, that's, I, as you've probably seen, there's loads of videos of me. You know, I'm sorry to have to have my image on all over the internet, but it's kind of helpful, really, because they can't threaten me with that now. You know, as far as I'm concerned, I'm in this wherever it goes. You know, if people want to take me out, then you know you're taking your time. I've been doing this for 8 years, and I haven't tried to, you know, sort of take out any protection or anything, because whatever happens, happens, basically. You know, when your numbers up, as far as I'm concerned, however that might be.
Right.
So, yeah, I think just going back to the forums for a minute, I think it's when you get in that level of activity, clearly the system or whatever it is, or the interests, are working hard to prevent you from gaining any ground on them, and you know that there is something behind what you're doing. Because if this was just, I think you made this point in your blog, but if this was just a silly conspiracy theory with no evidence, then, you know, would it be easy to refute it? You know, but what Paul McCartney has said doesn't give us any confidence that this is nonsense. But basically, if you look at what he's actually said, you know, and
because,
I think, sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Just when you said what McCartney says, he constantly makes references to his being a double. He talks about himself in the third person. Well, not about himself, but I mean, there's so many things he said. There's things just inaccurate statements. He said he joined the Beatles as a setup affair. Well, the original Paul didn't. He joined the Quarrymen. And then Paul said, or McCartney said, he was a year and a half older than George Harrison, when actually Paul was only 8 months older than George Harrison. So, I mean, there's all sorts of just inaccuracy.
Basic factual errors like that.
Yes.
Oh, that's pretty amazing.
Well, he forgets the details of his legend. I mean, basically, this is a legend. This is a CIA alias, or an intelligence agency level alias background story. He can't be expected to remember everything. I mean, the guy is like 70 years old, right?
yeah, absolutely.
I'm just going to say what you were saying about the forum, where you get a lot of opposition that actually can backfire on the disinfo agents, because I know one very good researcher was actually drawn in because of all of the resistance. He said, because all of these people are working so hard to debunk PID, there must be something to it. And he added a lot to the body of PID research. So, yes.
That's it. I think, you know, they've got to be very careful, because when they step over the line of, you know, like you say, the interest level, you know, because I mean, if it's me these days, I don't really post on forums much anymore. I'm just bored of it. You know, I've become a little bit more laid back now, and I'll do a few more leisure activities. You know, I used to be just doing this stuff sort of pretty non-stop when I wasn't doing work to earn money, you know. But now I'm actually sort of thinking, well, you know, I'm just going to take my time with it more now, you know, and just do bits and pieces when I feel like it, you know, because there's so many of these people, and that's kind of hard to take as well. You kind of think, well, how can it be that there are so many of these people who are covering up these criminal activities, which is what they are, you know, by our standards. You know, and I've seen the 9/11 truth movement. It's totally infiltrated. The people that actually are working for the real truth about 9/11, and probably the same with the fall issue. I call it a minority of a minority. You know, it really is. You're down to sort of fours and fives of people, you know, almost in the whole world sort of thing, you know. Because that's how powerful this disinformation is. It really is.
Well, we're fighting a machine. I mean, we're fighting the media. We're fighting McCartney with his vast billions of dollars. We're fighting the Illuminati, who can put in new old pictures of Paul that have been tampered. And so it's really, it's just, luckily we have people who have access to original pictures and original recordings. And so with the internet, it's so much easier to just compare things side by side. And before the internet, I don't think this really would have been possible.
Right, right. I tend to agree. Yeah.
The forums themselves are infiltrated, and they will shut down PID threads pretty fast.
That's I think worth saying, because that's what we found, particularly in relation to Judy Wood's research for 9/11. That's what I found similar. I mean, I think one of the things I can lay on the table for people to go and try and start a Wikipedia page about this, about Fall and Paul, and see how quickly it gets shut down. Because if you go and start a web page about my friend Dr. Judy Wood and the 9/11 research and her court case, and you put links into the court case, you can guarantee that that page will be gone in less than 48 hours. Because this has been done, I think, 3 times now. And it's always deleted within 48 hours, even though we've got reference to court documents with a court stamp on them, you know, and so on. So, you know, that proves how deep and wide this infiltration and control is.
And they were trying to shut down the internet freedom with the SOPA Act here in America, but luckily it seems to be shelved for now, but I'm sure it'll be reintroduced at some point. So people will just have to find ways around internet lockdown, I suppose.
Well, I think we've covered everything, Tina, and so I'd just like to say that I'm really glad that you've been able to spend some time speaking with me about this, and I think you've added a few more sort of aspects to this which I wasn't aware of, and I think do build this into a, you know, sort of fairly overwhelming case, certainly for me. I'm sure there'll be other people who still have sort of issues dealing with this. So have you any closing remarks on that side of things?
Well, I would like to thank you for getting exposure to the Paula's Dead issue. I think it's important for people to know that prominent people can be replaced, can be killed and replaced, and their replacement is used to influence people and promote an agenda that might not necessarily be for the public good. So people just need to be aware that this happens and keep their eyes sharp. And if they suspect something is wrong with somebody, they notice a physical difference or way somebody is acting, that they should investigate it with a mind to this replacement agenda.
Right, right. Absolutely. And I think, you know, again, it's all down to checking the evidence, thinking for yourself, not buying into the hype, whether that be in the mainstream media or now very much in the alternative media, because that is also becoming a force for hype, and trying to steer away from the what's been called fear porn, which is a term that I'll probably use more than I should, but we're getting a lot of that now. So again, Tina, I really thank you for your time, and I'll post this fairly soon. Thanks for listening. That was Andrew Johnson talking to Tina Foster on the 21st of January, 2012.